What's up, everybody? This week, Sarah and I took a look at one of the finest parody movies of all time, plus the seventh best Star Trek movie, Galaxy Quest. That and a whole lot more is to come on this week's episode of the 90s Podcast. Welcome to the show. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the 90s Podcast right here in the Because Movie Network. Hope you're doing well today, and I'm joined by Sarah Connolly. Sarah, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. You have a very, very Cheshire Cat grin on your face.
Because you won't look at me while you're speaking.
No, I...
Your eyes were closed the entire intro.
They were? Oh, I didn't know.
Yes. Because I was over here like grinning stupidly to make you crack up.
Probably.
And you just kept on. He's such a professional, everybody.
Yes, I know, because...
The consummate professional.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm very, very consummate in my professionalism, let me tell you. Yes. I run a professional outfit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's yeah.
But we're here for a reason today.
Yes, we are actually here for a reason, but I just want to make sure everybody's doing okay. And you had a good week?
I've had a week.
You had a very good
week. All days ended in Y. The air in the house, the central air is fixed.
Yeah, that's good.
We're already starting
to get the heat tier.
Yes. I was going to say, we're poor in funds, but richer in comfort. So there you go.
Oh, my word. Well, this week we are here to talk about...
Yes.
A wonderful, wonderful, wonderful parody movie.
It's one of the best.
One of the best parody movies. Now, it's not a Mel Brooks style parody where it takes three films, mashes them together, and rips on jokes of them.
No.
It's actually a parody of a genre.
Yes.
And not just a genre, but a subculture too.
Okay.
We're talking about 1999's Galaxy Quest.
Dude, you had me at Justin Long, Alan Rickman, and Sigourney Weaver. I am here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This is one of these movies that has a real, real good cast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great cast fits every single thing that you want to do.
Yes.
So let's talk about this movie for a minute. It was a comedy parody movie, and it's basically a sci-fi movie at the mm-hmm. same time.
Yes.
It was directed by Dean
Pariseau?
Yeah, he did...
D. Silent.
He's done things like... Red 2, Bill and Ted Face the Music, Fun with Dick and Jane.
Yeah.
So, you know, he
does the lighthearted type stuff.
Yes, he does.
Yes.
It was written by David Howard, a writer mm-hmm. whose information I don't have anything for, unfortunately.
Right.
But also Robert Gordon. Robert Gordon, for those of you who don't know, wrote Addicted to Love, Men in Black 2, and the movie Lemony Snicket's A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Oh, we like him.
So he did real, 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 real good. It was produced by Grand Via Productions, distributed by DreamWorks Productions, and was released Christmas Day 1999. Ooh, we're cutting it fine for the 90s.
I was going to say, one week
and we couldn't cover it.
As you would say, it's squeaky bum time.
Squeaky bum time.
Yes.
Do you know where that came from? That was a football reference.
Well, yeah, I knew that, but I didn't know where.
It was a commentator talking about like it was a 2-1 lead with 3 minutes to go for Manchester United.
Yeah.
And Sir Alex Ferguson must be thinking it's squeaky bum time right now.
Mm.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. This pulled in $90 million at the box office for a combined profit of $45.7 million.
Hey, hey, hey.
And is real, real critically acclaimed for what we judge it. Now, for those of you who don't know, we look at the IMDb rating.
Yes.
And the two scores on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
And smash them together to come up with our total.
Yes.
And this one came out at 81 out of 100, which is high.
For the genre, it is Afro Man high.
Yes. Yes. La da 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 da.
Yes. So, let's talk about the movie. Let's talk about the background of the movie.
Okay.
Right? So, writer David Howard was attending an IMAX movie presentation, and the old school ones, now we're not talking about like now you can see anything on IMAX, but back in the day, it was like all documentaries and stuff. Like, it was educational. Yes. If you went to IMAX, like,
did you have to wear the glasses with the blue?
No, no, that's 3D.
Okay,
but IMAX, especially the early ones, like, you would go and you would sit down. The room was a circle.
Yes.
And your seat sort of reclined back, and the entire ceiling was projected the movie. And the speakers and stuff are all around you, like, they're built into the seats and stuff. So it's like you're there, right?
Right.
And these things used to scare the bejesus out of kids during, like, they took a whole bunch of us to go see some of these movies when I was in middle school. And I was so mad because some of the other kids got to go to, like, the really fast, cool ones, like, you know, roller coasters around the world. Okay. And so you're sitting there and it feels like you're on the roller coaster, right? Like, do you remember when we went to the Lego movie and it was like 4D because they were spraying the water? It was like kind of like, it was like that, but without the, I mean, you were there, right?
Okay, I got you.
Yeah. But I went to one that was like volcano eruptions. Well, of course, everybody got close because they had a bird to death. I was so upset. Anyway, so David Howard went to an IMAX movie presentation, and it was he saw a trailer for a movie called Americans in Space, which was narrated by our favorite space guy, Leonard Nimoy.
Yes.
Yes.
Second favorite.
Who's
you
your first?
You dishonor the name of Lieutenant Worf.
Okay. But at the time... What year did...
TNG ended in 93.
It ended in 93?
Yes.
Jeez, I'm so old. Okay. From the original series.
I'll accept that.
He's our favorite Vulcan.
Yes.
For all time.
All time.
There will never be a better Vulcan than Spock.
Never.
Okay. So...
That is the logical conclusion.
Isn't it, though? Okay. So, Leonard Nimoy is narrating this film that the trailer is for. So, it's this trailer that's being advertising for this film. So, Howard became fascinated by the idea of how, like, Star Trek actors and other sci-fi actors had pretty much pigeonholed themselves as to only be sci-fi actors.
Yeah.
Right. So, he's sitting there and he's watching all this and he's like, I wonder what would happen if, like, real aliens came to Earth needing help. Like, who would help them?
Yes.
So.
Producer Mark Johnson.
Yes.
I don't know what credits he's got. I overlooked that.
Yes. So, he gets a hold of the script after it's written. And, you know, he's a little hesitant at first. He didn't really like the original. But he liked the idea of aliens needing help. And then handed the script over to Bob Gordon. Right.
Who did all the movies that we spoke about earlier.
Right. So Gordon took the script and he added more humor to it. He zhuzhed it up, as we call it. Okay. You know. So, you know, and then he began to put more of, like, the dramatic elements, which, like, everything with Rickman. Oh, my God. Alan Rickman.
Stole the show.
Alan Rickman steals every show.
Yes.
I mean, for... Name me an Alan Rickman movie where he was not just... Mwah.
I can't, but I could tell you one where he stole the show only to be upstaged. Dogma.
By Alanis?
No, by Muse.
What? The Muse was Chris Rock?
No, Muse. Jason Muse.
Oh, yeah, Jason Muse. Well, yeah, but... Jason Muse is not... Yeah, no, but I'm talking about, like, the rest of the thing. Like,
no.
Yeah. So, I mean, Hitchhiker's Guide, I mean, all he did was voice over a robot, and he stole the entire thing. An android. Yes.
Marvin the Paranoid Android, not a robot.
Okay, so, sorry, I'm a little rambly tonight.
Yes.
That's
why I'm just letting...
You'll know.
That's why I'm just letting you talk.
Yes, I do that well. So, now, all right, y'all, story time. Okay, so he wrote all the more dramatic elements, which helped make the movie more than just a comedy. Like, it needed to have some depth.
Yes.
Right. So, because he writes up this whole script of awesomeness, he hands it over to DreamWorks, and they're like, yes, green light. cast it.
Go.
Make this happen. Right? So, and then what happened, dear?
Well, you can't do sci-fi without busting a few ghosts.
Mm.
So they went to Mr. Egon himself, Harold Ramis.
They certainly weren't calling Bill Murray.
No. Although they might have put in a call to Dan Aykroyd, I'm not sure. Anyway, they got him in, and he wanted the movie to be more like a straight Mel Brooks style parody, like Spaceballs.
Right.
And the studio didn't necessarily want that.
No.
They pushed back on that, didn't want any sci-fi people involved in the whole thing. And when Sigourney Weaver came on board, he pushed back against that because he didn't want her. I mean, Sigourney Weaver was the queen of sci-fi.
Yeah, sort of.
I mean, Alien.
Well, Aliens and Ghostbusters. Yeah.
I mean, you know, she had it all. And even though she went to him and said, look, I'd be the best person for this role because he was still hesitant. And then he walked out on the project. When Tim Allen was cast, because he wanted Alec Baldwin. I'm sorry, but Alec Baldwin in 1999,
he could have done it. I'm gonna argue with this one.
You can argue with it. I just don't see it.
Okay, stop for a second. Clear your mind.
Mine's clear.
Take away every preconceived notion you have on anything. Okay. You're looking, it's honestly built for a Shatner-esque character.
Right.
Okay. So think of Baldwin.
Okay.
Baldwin can put himself in anything. And we've known, just from all of his SNL stuff, he has great comedic timing.
Oh, he does. He does.
So
very good actors have very good comedic timing, and very good comedic actors have very good acting timing.
Well, no, I know some straight actors who
just watch
comedy.
Just watch Airplane. Right. All the serious actors who showed up for that movie.
Okay, yes, but they were they were outliers.
Patrick Stewart. Patrick Stewart is one of the greatest actors who ever lived, and he is a comic genius.
Yes, but
Ian McKellen.
Okay.
David Tennant. My homeboy Michael Sheen. My homeboy Anthony Hopkins.
Can you dial back to this side of the pond for just a second, please? What I'm trying to tell you is that Alec Baldwin.
Okay.
Can he be a jerk? Absolutely. But this character is that.
Yes. I mean, I agree with that. I just there's a reason why I can only see Tim Allen playing this character. Because of the fact that Tim Allen, with the exception of maybe Buzz Lightyear, and even plays the same guy over and over again, and it's the oblivious jerk.
Mm.
Tim the Toon Man was an oblivious jerk.
He's still a jerk.
He was still a jerk, but he was oblivious to the fact. Buzz Lightyear, Santa Claus.
I'm just not really a Tim Allen person. No,
I've never been a fan of Tim Allen except in this movie where he nails it and dials it in perfectly.
Okay. Well, we're just gonna agree to disagree, but I still think Alec Baldwin would have been better.
Okay.
So
but it's after that Harold Ramis left the project and Dean Pariseau came on board. And he cast the movie the way he wanted it cast, and he wanted serious actors in this movie.
Right.
I mentioned Airplane just a minute ago, but that was kind of an inspiration.
Right.
Getting more, you know, I mean, Alan Rickman, right? Alan Rickman is a serious actor, like a thespian, and he does comedy really, really well. It's another example of, you know, and in fact, his character is called Sir Alexander Dane.
Yeah.
So, you know, he is one of those thespian.
He's
tread
a
the boards
thespian.
Yes.
He wants to do Shakespeare at the Globe.
Yes pretty much.
Yes.
And then you got Tim Allen playing all these guys play two characters, and what I mean by that is they play
the actor they're supposed to be and then the character that actor was. It's Movieception,
yes.
Really. Okay.
So Tim Allen plays Jason Nesmith, or Commander Quincy Taggart in the Galaxy Quest TV series. Sigourney Weaver plays Gwen DeMarco, Lieutenant Tony Madison. Mm-hmm. And Alan Rickman plays Sir Alexander Dane or Dr. Lazarus. Dr. Lazarus is this kind of alien hybrid creature.
Yeah.
Who they use the classical actor to do that, and they've got him saying all these cheesy lines.
Right. Now, if you go on, though, and look at some of the supporting cast, and there's
The supporting cast is what makes this movie.
Yeah, and we won't go through all of them, but some of them that you do know. Tony Shalhoub, he went on to play Monk and a few other well-known characters. He's awesome. Of course, Justin Long.
Yeah.
Who plays Brandon. Rainn Wilson
is one of the aliens.
Yes. Which I had completely forgotten about until just now. Like, he plays it so well, and it is such a different direction from everything he's done since, like with The Office and whatnot.
And Missy Pyle, mm-hmm. who can play anything.
Yes.
And Sam Rockwell.
Yeah.
Sam Rockwell's character is my favorite character in the whole movie. It really is. And we'll get to why here in a minute. He plays Guy Fleegman, mm-hmm. a.k.a. Security Officer Guy Fleegman, a.k.a. Red Shirt number 6.
Yes.
So we'll get to this. We've got paragraph. We've got a long, 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 long list of... We got 4 pages of plot.
Okay, so we're going to go through this, and we're going to alternate, so that way it's not monotonous.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start.
Okay.
Okay. Galaxy Quest was once a popular geek television series that eventually got canceled, but was so popular among a cult group that it has spawned 18 annual conventions where fans gather, often in costumes based on the series, to watch old episodes, meet cast members and actors who played even small roles on single episodes. At Galaxy Quest 18, hosted by Guy Fleegman, an actor who played in episode 81 and died by the first commercial, the fans are seeing a lost episode, which is part of a two-parter dealing with the Omega 13 device. As this episode is screening in the main room, backstage sits the original cast and crew.
Yeah, so basically what it's saying is every Star Trek, Red Dwarf, Star mm-hmm. Wars convention you can think of, it spawned that.
Right.
So this came out in 99, so 18 years previously would have been 81?
Yeah.
Okay, so this was a 70s and 80s TV show.
Yeah.
That the reruns, I guess, made it popular.
Yeah.
Kind of like the original Star Trek.
Very much so.
So, the original cast and crew. So, Alexander Dane, who played half-human, half-alien Dr. Lazarus, laments about how he was once a great actor on the English stage.
Mm.
The beautiful and voluptuous Gwen DeMarco, who played sexy communications officer Lieutenant Tony Madison, whose only duty on the ship was to repeat what the computer said, complains that her TV guide article was all about her bust line and how it fit into her uniform. Tommy Weber, the child actor, has since grown up and found no other life outside of Galaxy Quest conventions, remarks about how the commander and the star of the series, Jason Nesmith, is no more than an hour late.
Well, eventually, Nesmith finally shows up and gets into the been there, done that groove, asking if Dane has already done his I was once an actor thing.
He called it a panic attack, I think he did.
This, plus the fact that Nesmith is about to do a solo gig without the rest of the cast, almost has everyone walking out of the dressing room and heading for home. As Jason tries to explain, the gig is a couple of kids with cardboard in a garage and nothing major. Out on the convention floor, Guy now starts introducing the crew of Galaxy Quest, who snaps into their roles, especially Dane, after Nesmith says the magic words to convince him that the show must go on. They go outside to the waiting fans, the spotlights, and the roar of the crowds to sit down and sign autographs and give the fans a taste of the dream. Basically, it's a panel at Comic-Con.
Well, it wasn't supposed to be a panel. He was supposed to show up an hour earlier. They were supposed to get out there and do some Q&A, and then it turned into an autograph signing.
Well, yeah, but that's what panels are.
Well, yeah, but in this one, the panel didn't happen because of the lateness of the character.
Yeah.
I love the line, "You can't make me go out there. Show must go on." Damn you. Mm-hmm. Love it. Gwen happens to smile at Nesmith because basically Tommy told hysterically funny and true crack about how the fans love Nesmith almost as much as Nesmith loves himself. In that brief moment, Nesmith sees Gwen and remembers the times were once and hopes for a rekindling of an old set romance, which Gwen promptly shoots down, and when fans ask if she and the commander once had a thing, Glenn replies, And Gwen replies, had Nesmith come up behind her, they never had. Sorry, that was a bit wordy.
Hang on. Okay.
I think this review was written in Google Translate.
Yeah.
It is a little trip over. Anyway, so basically they see a kindling of some old, the fancy yeah. kindling of some old.
So yeah, she's telling the people there at the convention, no, we never. And he's come up behind her and he's like, really? Like, really? And she's like, yeah, no, never. No.
She would rather poop in her hands and clap.
Yes. So Gwen is ushered off by officials to do a look-alike Tawny Madison contest with fans in a costume photo shoot. Nesmith is trying to follow and is confronted by Mathazar, an actual alien come to Earth to seek the help of Commander Peter Quincy Taggart, the character played by Nesmith on Galaxy Quest. Nesmith thinks this is a group of kids who are paying him to do the appearance, the same group from earlier, in their garage tomorrow, and tells them to keep things hush-hush, finalize details with his agent, and bring a limousine. The brushed-off alien contingent mutter a little bit and go off to do as he asks, while Nesmith tries to corner Gwen, who brushes him off with a "it was cute before I got to know you" line.
Ouch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'd feel sorry for him if he wasn't such a jerk.
Yeah.
Nesmith eventually goes into the men's room and locks himself in the bathroom, where he overhears two non-geeks who are mocking the whole Galaxy Quest event and calls the stars losers who haven't done anything since the series ended.
Ooh.
Especially Nesmith, who's badmouthed by his co-stars.
Mm.
Nesmith gets the wake-up call he finally needs and falls totally out of character for the rest of the day. He signs autographs with a phone-it-in mentality and doesn't look at the fans when confronted with real host. Sorry, and doesn't even look at the fans. And when confronted by the real host of his next day gig, turns on them, gets angry, and informs them it's just a television series. Gwen overhears this, and later that night she speaks with fellow co-star Dane about this on the telephone from their retrospective homes, expresses concern that Nesmith has never done that before. Dane just expresses contempt for the whole thing.
Of course he does. It's Alan Rickman.
I don't know if you noticed or not. He's at home right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now he plays an alien that's got, like, makeup done and everything like that. When he's home, he hasn't washed the makeup off yet.
Yeah, he's still got
the head thing on.
Yeah, he still looks like a ram. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, we're back to Nesmith now. So, he has climbed back into his bottle of booze on ice, watching episodes of Galaxy Quest on television, and waking up with Mathazar and his fellow aliens come knocking on his back door. Nesmith doesn't quite rise to the occasion and more like crawls around in his shirt and underwear looking for shoes.
Yeah.
Eventually, they all get into a limousine and head to the gig with Nesmith trying to make a play for the pretty alien girl, Lalari, who cannot speak because her translator device broke. Nesmith asks for a Coca-Cola and promptly takes a nap as they explain the situation to him on the way up to the ship, which is the real Starship NSEA Protector.
Yes. So he misses all the fun.
Right.
And doesn't realize what's going on.
No, not at all.
So once there, the unshaven, groggy, and very unkempt Nesmith is taken onto the bridge, where he confronts the evil reptilian warlord Saris on the video screen. Mm-hmm. Nesmith arrogantly but wittingly orders him to fire blue and red lasers, and among other things. He says, "That should take care of old lobster head." Then he has to be taken back home to Earth. Mathazar really appreciates that Nesmith, unaware of the importance of his actions, has saved his people. Nesmith is shown to a room where he's covered by goop that turns into a plastic shell. He's then shot out into space, landing into his home by his swimming pool in a complete state of shock and realization, oh crap, that really happened. That was real.
Right. So still unshaven and unkempt, he runs to the electronics store opening they have been contracted to do and informs his fellow actors about his real adventures in space with the termites, as he calls them. Everyone thinks he's drunk and crazy, even after Mathazar and his fellow aliens show up and want him and the crew to come up and negotiate with Saris. Nesmith tries to convince his fellow actors to come along and help him. Instead, they all give Nesmith the brush off and leave, climbing into the same van, hostile and critical, except for Fred Kwan, who played Tech Sergeant Chen on the series, and said they all should have taken the gig because who knows when Nesmith would offer them a gig again.
Yeah, so they think he's crazy, but at the same time, it's like, oh, there's a gig in this one. Let's see where it goes. I love the Shaloub in this one. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
Probably steals the movie. Rickman steals the movie, but
yeah,
I don't know.
Shaloub is right there. Yeah.
Yeah. After they all say a gig, looking at each other, getting out the van, they meet up with Lorelai, whose image remains on Earth. Nesmith thought they might change their minds. They believe this is another performance opportunity that Nesmith is hogging for himself and demand that they join Nesmith aboard the ship. Mm-hmm. Larry opens up pods for all of them, and in short order, the acting crew of Galaxy Quest realize they're now on the real deal in outer space, that it's a little more reality than they were planning on. We see the aliens in their real form for the first time, and type of pastel octopus is a squid. He used device to take human shape and speech. There's a part here where Guy goes with them, the mm-hmm. guy, the host of the Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
And they touch down in the transporter room or something like that. And they start prodding them with medical stuff.
Yeah.
And he just loses his mind.
It's hysterical. He does a really good job.
He also did in the convention, we skipped over that part, but in the sign-ins, he thought, yeah, I want to sign some of my own autographs. And he got 8x10s made up of him in the Galaxy Quest uniform.
Mm-hmm.
He signed a crewman number 8, right? Episode 5.
Lordy help. So out of all the actors that are there, right, Fred Kwan, Tony Shalhoub's character, is the only one who is like, because of all of the Hollywood stuff they've been through and everything, he's like, cool, let's do it. Let's what you got for me?
Yeah, he's baked out of his brain, basically.
Right, right. And then Gwen and Dane are the only sane ones who think it's totally insane to do this, to actually be on a spaceship. Tommy's trying to deal with all of this. That's the former child actor. They get a tour of the space dock, go aboard the ship where they get more of a tour, and then meet the crew and other termites, as Nesmith calls them. They take their place on the bridge, take the ship out into space, and meet with Saris. And they find out they are actually in real danger.
Yeah, that scene right there when they're on the bridge is like Tommy sitting at the control desk,
mm-hmm.
and you know all the guys come in to watch them take the ship out, and he's like, "Ooh, no pressure, huh? Hate to see what happens next." And then they call out, "Tommy, you got to take us out." And he looks around like, "What, me?"
Green, yeah.
So we learn that Matthews and his people think that the Earth television is a serious documentary news, and that series like Galaxy Quest, Gilligan's Island, and so on are reality television like news reports. So they call them historical documents.
The way that they mourned the Gilligan's Island people, I laughed my ass off at that. Keep going.
Those poor people.
Poor people.
Gwen didn't take issue with Nesmith is going along with this blindly because they think he's on an ego trip, and maybe he is. He sure likes inspecting the troops, and the audience eventually discovers that Saris has captured and tortured the last commander who told Saris about all things on Galaxy Quest, including the coveted Omega-13 device, which Saris wants to own at all costs. The Thermians don't know about the Omega-13, but badly constructed, the device will disintegrate matter in every atom in the universe. Nobody knows where it is or what it does. So imagine hauling that around.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But all of this sends the actors packing, except for Nesmith, who still thinks he can deal with Saris. However, Nesmith has to deal with him as Saris has arrived, and they must confront him. So it's one thing to postulate on the bridge, oh yeah, I could take him, but then he ends up like nose to nose. So the Thermians have constructed the Protector exactly to the series specifications, but don't know how to operate her.
Yeah.
So think about this. For all Star Trek fans, imagine how many blueprints of the Enterprise, the different versions of the Enterprise or Deep Space Nine or whatever, are available on the internet that fans have put together based on shots and models and this. So it's same
even
thing.
In TNG, they've even got the ship blueprint on the back screen and
right.
in engineering.
It's right. So it's just like that. So,
Saris overhears Nesmith speaking about his plans on attacking him with all their weapons because Gwen didn't follow Nesmith's order to cease the microphone because she didn't know. He said, cut the mic. And she's like, yeah, I know how to do this. I'm an actress. This is a real ship. Hello, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Saris shoots first. There's a great thing. Hey, Jason, there's a red thingy coming after a blue thingy. I think we're the blue thing.
Yeah.
So the engine dies off, but Synergy leads the Protector through the Tothian minefield, abandoned since an old war. When they leave the minefield, the Protector has taken heavy damage, disabling their power core. So basically, Saris shoots them and they run. They panic.
Right. So the crew is trying to explain that the Galaxy Quest adventures are merely fiction.
not historical documents. We're talking about like the not the alien crew, but like our humanoid actor crew, right? But the concept isn't really resonating with the aliens because they have just started to understand the concept of lies and deceit as Saris promises something and then does another thing. A new sphere of the energy source called beryllium is found on a planet nearby, so they have to go and pick them. Arriving to the planet where the sphere is, it looks like a rocky Nevada desert, and they can breathe naturally. A kind of home appears. Some cute little monkeys are working on the mines. Guy is worried that he's the extra, the sixth crew member, who hasn't got even a simple surname. One of the cute little monkeys is weak and sick, so the rest of the mining monkeys consume it alive.
I love this sequence.
Yes, it is hysterical.
The best thing about this, right, the reason why I love the character Guy so much is that he is the audience.
Oh, yeah.
He is like, they touch down on an alien planet and they open the door. You don't know if there's breathable air in there. What the hell are you doing? You know, he's just...
He points out what we are thinking. Yes. Yeah.
And... You know, he's like, I'm going to die. He's like, no, you're not going to die. What's my last name, huh? They didn't give me. And he's throwing an absolute panic attack.
Right.
So the crew attempts to steal one of these beryllium spheres by rolling it away. Hundreds of monkeys appear. The protector leaves with the protector's ship, the little shuttle ship that they brought down with them, leaves with the spear, but without Nesmith. As Lazarus complains, Nesmith always needs to be the center of attention. I love that line. Mm-hmm. I love that bit. He's just, oh, it had to be you, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a large animal is about to consume Nesmith, but the animal is transported up onto the protector. And everybody recoils in horror. Except for one of the Thermians, who's just standing there, diddly-dee.
Uh-huh.
What happened?
Well, as soon as... As soon as Pseudo O'Brien teleported somebody to the ship, he exploded.
Turned inside out.
Yes.
And exploded.
Yes. So while all this is going on in the ship, main ship, the monkeys keep on shouting
Grognak.
Grognak, which is an enormous rock monster. Finally, Nesmith is transported to the protector.
Now, there's a little bit more than what it just says here. I'm gonna break that down real quick. He's not just transported back. What happens is Shaloub, Fred Kwan, doesn't know what to do.
Right.
He's lost all his confidence, not only as an actor, but in his character. And then all of a sudden, he sees one of the Thermians eyeing him up. And all of a sudden, he gets his confidence.
He can do it now. It's like a Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah.
So once we're all back on the protector, we find out that Saris has invaded the ship. Apart from that, Nesmith is told that there are no more people on planet Earth. Nesmith says there's no use in torturing Mathazar as he doesn't know what the Omega 13 device really is. He and Gwen show the historical documents before Saris, who immediately understands the situation. He forces Nesmith to explain to Mathazar in simple words that a child can understand that they're not heroes, but only actors. So the jig is up.
Yeah, they got everything working and just...
Yeah.
Yeah. So Saris orders his guards, they're going to make the starship explode with everybody inside.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and Nesmith and Lazar pretend to fight and use the distraction to throw their guardians into space. Gwen reminds Nesmith that neither of them know how to activate a neutron reactor, but Nesmith knows somebody who does and will know who can operate it.
Mm-hmm.
He reaches out to Brandon.
And we actually met Brandon in the very beginning. He's a nerdy guy who was asking a great deal of technical questions during the first convention, like when we first meet everybody.
Which is when he snaps at the fan and storms off.
So it was actually Brandon that he snapped at. So, Gwen and Nesmith follow Brandon and his friend Kyle's instructions. When asked what the Omega 13 device may do, Brandon says they think that it will allow people to go back in time 13 seconds. Just 13.
So there's a bit, right, where they come up with chompers, as they call them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Omega 13 device is hidden on the ship with the chompers.
I love the edit that they did on that. They had to keep it PG-13.
Mm-hmm.
And you can quite clearly read Sigourney Weaver's lips, but the dub says, screw that. But you can clearly read her lips. She is not saying screw that.
Mm-mm, no. Right? So Lazarus and Aquilic open the door to bring oxygen to the Thermians, because what has happened in all this is the bad guy has double-crossed everybody again.
Yeah, shock horror gasp.
Right. So while Nesbitt and Gwen, so while Jason and Gwen are off trying to get the Omega-13 device, the big bad is now put all of our good little cute aliens, the Thermites, into an airlock chamber, and he has turned the oxygen off.
Yes.
So they are suffocating.
So it's up to Lazarus and Quillick, who's a Thermian, to open the doors to bring oxygen to the Thermians.
Yes.
And how they do that is they distract...
Yes.
...some of Saris's guys by using the teleporter again.
Mm-hmm.
And bring up Grognak to basically chase everybody off and out into space.
Hey, you do what you gotta do.
After seeing this Lorelai and Fred kiss like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is ew.
Yeah. So, all that's going on. Nesbitt, so Jason and Gwen have gone through the little, you know...
Little chompers.
Yes, they've gone through the chompers.
With Sigourney Weaver yelling, whoever wrote this episode should be shot.
Right. So, there's a blue button which stops the explosion. Brandon can't help Nesbitt, and ends up giving him an alternate solution when the blue button doesn't stop the countdown because his mother forces him to take out the trash. There's a lot going on during this segment. So after all is said and done, Nesbitt and Gwen embrace, listening to the last seconds of the countdown.
Because they're expecting to die. That's the end of it. You know, they can't stop the reactor from blowing up.
Right. So they think, this is it. It's been nice knowing you. But what they don't remember is on the series, the countdown always used to stop a second before it was due to explode. And that's what happened.
So they end up back on the bridge. They've taken control of the ship back, and they need to dispatch of Saris. Mm-hmm. So Nesbitt orders Tommy to drive the Protector back into the minefield. There, the magnetism of the ship attracts many, many mines. The Protector faces Saris' flagship and goes down to the last second. What happens here is a great back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Saris is like, oh, look, the actors want to play war. Mm-hmm. I've fought many, many wars, Sonny. And he goes, yeah, but what you don't understand is my ship is dragging mines.
Mm-hmm.
And he blasts what mines he took from the minefield into Saris's ship.
Yes.
Saris's flagship is destroyed. So the crew need to go home. And the only way to do that is to go through a black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Alexander mentions there's an increase of energy from Saris' flagship right before the explosion. Saris has entered the Protector. Disguised as Fred, he shoots Nesbitt and the rest of the crew, ironically except Guy. So Guy's the only one that doesn't get killed.
Right? That is hysterical.
Nesbitt shouts to Mathazar to activate the Omega-13, so he arrives back in time. 13 seconds to be exact. But enough time to stop Saris as soon as he enters the control room. There's a brilliant part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mathazar is like, has been completely and utterly tortured, and he's on crutches.
Yeah.
And he just beats the living crap out of the dude with his crutch.
Hysterical. Absolutely hysterical. So, once, you know, it's all done. Most of the Thermians leave the Protector at this point, except for Lalliari. They arrive at the sci-fi convention they were supposed to attend in the first place, where thousands of fans are already disappointed they're not here. But those people perk up pretty quickly when a ship crash lands right there in the middle of the convention hall, thanks to Brandon and his friends. In the convention, each cast member leaves the ship half suffocated and dizzy. Saris also wakes up, but he is killed in a second, something which drives the fans wild because they all think
it's part of the show.
It's part of the show.
Show must go on.
Yes. So, and then at the end, we wrap up finding out that Galaxy Quest has been renewed. The cast includes a character called Lalliari, performed by Jane Doe, who kisses Fred, and a new security lieutenant performed by the extra actor, Guy Fleegman.
Yes, so he finally gets his...
he gets his shot.
He gets his wings, God bless him. Yeah, I mean, I love that movie. Just the way it goes into everything.
Oh yeah,
we did miss one part out on there, and I don't know. Have we kicked?
Keep going.
We did miss one part out on there. There's a tragedy in there as Quillick is killed, one of the Thermians. And that causes Alan Rickman to go absolutely guano psychotic.
Yes.
To the point where you can see his hair poking out of his headpiece.
The little rubber headpiece gets, it's hysterical.
So this film is, this film has like four main themes to it. And the first one is friendship. And at the beginning of the movie, the casts are not on good terms.
Right.
They particularly hate Jason Nesmith as he steals the spotlight in solo gigs without his crew, especially during the opening argument, the whole movie that they have. As the adventures go on, they begin to bond, especially during the scenes with Saris. It's like they realize that it's all for one.
Right.
The Thermians are 100% solidarity with all Toms because they're the last of their people.
Right.
So
you also have sci-fi and type casting. Mainly about how, the actors who were shoehorned into being only sci-fi actors. This has happened in real life where the majority of sci-fi actors in major shows and movies get typecast and don't do as much work outside of that. That was true definitely when this was filmed. Actually, in the last maybe 10 years or so, that's gotten a little better.
It has.
But definitely when this was filmed, typecasting was y'all. So only the biggest stars get to move in and out, like Shatner, Stewart, and Ford were able to break out of their roles. The actors, as I say, like William Shatner, he's done stuff like on Boston Legal and other shows. Of course, Patrick Stewart is Patrick Stewart, and Harrison Ford. Yeah. So now he just tells people to get off of his plane. So
tells people to get off his porch too. He's a grumpy old man.
Oh, he is. He is. He's hysterical though. But the actors of the movie were not able to get another gig outside of convention signings and media appearances since the show left the air in 86. And despite being classically trained actors, in Sir Alexander Dane's case,
I think he's the Patrick Stewart.
Yes.
Avatar.
Yes.
Yeah. They also talk about war. The Thermians are involved in a bloody war with Saris's race.
Right.
They have no military experience or personnel to fight such a thing.
Nope.
However, they have adapted their science and culture to a point they can build a working starship.
That's pretty darn cool.
That's good science right there. Saris, however, is a military general, has fought in many campaigns and against many foes, but he was not able to defeat a bunch of actors on a ship that he knew nothing about.
I love that.
Yeah.
You also have the theme of innocence, because in that, the Thermians are almost childlike. I mean, they didn't even know you could be lied to until Saris did such. They believe that the Earth's TV shows are actually all based on real events, like those poor people on the boat.
Yes.
Poor people.
Poor people.
They still try and negotiate peace with Saris, despite all the pain and suffering he's caused them. And then you've got the innocence of Brandon and his friends, believing that the ship and crew are real, also mirrors that. From meeting the crew at the first Galaxy Fest to helping Nesmith and DeMarco in the final act.
Yeah. So, it says a lot that everybody grows.
Right.
So that there is good character. I think the only person who doesn't grow is Shaloub's character.
He does, because he's all scared and stuff. And then, then the idea of being in love. Yeah.
Especially with an alien.
Well, I mean, I was in love with an alien.
Oh, thank you.
I know, right?
E.T.
Best souvenir ever.
Yes.
Keep going.
I know how to do the laundry.
It makes a freaking fabulous parsley sauce.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so let's look at what happened behind the camera.
Okay.
Sam Rockwell, Guy Fleegman, stole the movie. He based his portrayal on Bill Paxton's performance in the James Cameron classic Aliens.
Oh, okay.
His elevated fear of being killed and his mental collapse upon seeing motion detector shows that the enemy is closing in on. So that whole thing where Bill Paxton just absolutely loses his mind.
Right.
That's the whole premise of the Guy character.
That's hysterical. Gwen DeMarco laments that her TV Guide interview was 6 paragraphs of my boobs and how they fit into my suit. This actually happened to Jeri Ryan, who played 7 of 9 on Star Trek Voyager and Picard.
Yes.
Yes, I love
that. Did you know that... Have you heard of the Ryan domino effect? The DS9 domino effect?
Hit me.
Okay, if it wasn't for Star Trek Deep Space Nine... Right. Star Trek Voyager, excuse me. Right. Barack Obama would not have been president.
Okay.
Okay. Jerry Ryan was dating, was married to a man.
Yes.
Who's a politician in the Chicago area. Jake Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And he was running for office.
Yes.
While their marriage imploded.
I remember that.
And all the gossip got out there and all the juicy stuff.
Oh, that's right.
And he lost his political race to a young Barack Obama.
Oh, to the young community organizer.
Yes. And Obama went to the Senate and then went to run for presidency.
Well, okay, Miss Ryan.
Yes. So just after the crew arrives in their pods, the Thermians appear without their appearance generators. When the captain asks who wants a tour, Sigourney Weaver did not know the guy was going to scream in terror as he did. So that scream that he did and her reaction was absolutely genuine because she didn't know he was going to do that.
That is hysterical. You also have in here that Alexander Dane never removes his headpiece throughout the entire film, even when he and Gwen DeMarco are speaking to each other by home phone. Yes.
So, yeah, we mentioned that.
Yeah.
Let me see what else we got here. Tony Shalhoub's character of Fred Kwon was written and acted with the idea that he was high for the entire movie. That's why he's unfazed by the events occurring around him and why he's constantly holding a bag of snacks.
Right.
Which probably, so he doesn't see them as aliens. He sees them as real people, I guess, because he was so baked the whole.
Right. Despite frequent whining about his character, crew member number six, being expendable and going to die, Guy Fleegman is the only crew member not to be shot and killed by SARS during his surprise assault. That's funny.
Yes. That's ironic. I think that was definitely by design, not coincidence. Yes.
Right.
So. What I wanted to know, going from behind the scenes, though, however, was the reaction from people who worked in the Star Trek universe, excuse me. Because right. This film leans heavily on the Trek stuff, and it just came out after the, you know, TNG hadn't long ended after it was written. And so, you know, I looked up reactions from people who starred in the Star Trek universe.
Right.
So this is a quote from Sir Patrick Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
I'd originally not wanted to see Galaxy Quest because I heard he was going to be making fun of Star Trek. Then Jonathan Frakes, Commander Riker,
mm-hmm.
rang me up and said, you must not miss this movie. See it on a Saturday night in the full theater. I did, twice. And of course, I thought it was brilliant. No one laughed longer, louder, or harder than cinema than I did. The idea that the ship saved and all of our heroes in the movie simply saved for the fact that the fans who did understand the scientific principles of the ship worked absolutely, and it was wonderful. And it was both funny and touching, and it paid tribute and dedication to these fans. So he saw it more as a homage to the fan base mm-hmm. rather than a parody of the... And it's both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really is both. Tim Russ, who played Tuvok in Star Trek Voyager and Picard.
Right.
I've had flashbacks of Galaxy Quest, the many conventions I've gone to since the movie came out. I thought it was an absolute laugh a minute. And there's one more reaction I'm going to let you read.
I loved Galaxy Quest. I thought it was brilliant satire, not only of Trek, but of a fandom in general. The only thing I wish they had done was cast me in it and have me play a... freaky fanboy who keeps screaming at the actor who played the kid about how awful it was and that there was a kid on the spaceship. Alas. And that was by Will Wheaton, who played Wesley Crusher.
The kid.
Yes, the kid.
Sarah, your rating of this movie?
A 30 out of 10.
Yeah. What's your opinion on it?
It's hysterical. There's tons of in-jokes. The people that are in it are just fantastic. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. And yeah. So don't drink a lot while watching it because you'll laugh.
It'll come out your nose.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's 10 out of 10. I really do. I think it's one of the greatest parody movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Rockwell, Tony Shalhoub steal the movie for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, Rickman did a good job in his role, but his role was to be a disgruntled actor.
Right.
And Rickman always came across as a disgruntled actor.
This is true.
I love how everyone thanks Nesmith for saving them, even though it was a team effort.
Right.
So every time the crew saves everybody, they thank Nesmith for it. I just thought that was a cool joke. The dramatic pieces are there as well. You know, I liked the dramatic pieces of everything. And, yeah, I mean, the idea of wash-up actors saving the world may seem far-fetched, but they had years of storyline training to be able to do something.
Right.
You know, they knew something.
Right.
You know,
I just think of, like, somebody asked one of the actors on Grey's Anatomy,
You know, but you've played an actor now for 10 years on this show. Like, you've played a surgeon. Could you, if I were to fall out right here, could you save me? He was like, well, I could definitely keep you alive until real help got here. Like, I've learned that much. So, yeah.
Well, the film is actually really popular with Star Trek fans.
Mm-hmm.
At the 2013 Star Trek convention in Las Vegas, it received enough support that it was included in the 12 Star Trek films that have been released on the voting ballot. So this technically is the 7th best Star Trek film ever made.
That is hysterical.
The movie spotlighted actors who were going to have career renaissances or have amazing careers.
Mm-hmm.
So you had Alan Rickman,
yes.
Renaissance with the Harry Potter series.
Yes.
Rainn Wilson and Tony Shalhoub would get roles in The Office and Monk, respectively. And it launched Justin Long's career.
It launched his comedic career because, I mean, we all knew him from the Bee Eating You, the Jeepers Creepers.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. It shows you can do a parody without being too over the top, so not like Mel Brooks' parodies.
Right.
You know, and this is considered one of the best parody movies of all time, and it was started off the parody renaissance that lasted for 3 movies. Do you know what those 3 movies were?
Mm.
Galaxy Quest,
mm-hmm.
Scary Movie,
mm-hmm.
Scary Movie 2. And then it went to the dogs. And we'll get to that later on in the season when I talk about Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yes.
So, Sarah, it was awesome to have you on. Thank you for sharing this moment with me. Did we beat the clock?
No. And for anybody who's wondering what that reference is to, go back and look on Twitter.
Like, yes.
Well, yeah, look at the mentions for the podcast.
Yes. So, mm-hmm. Sarah, it was good to have you on. I'll be back here in a couple of minutes. Sarah will be back next week, and I'll tell you what we're talking about next week here in a couple of minutes.
Awesome sauce.
Bye. Sincere thanks to Sarah for coming on once again. I do appreciate it. She is very, very busy. If you want to get in touch with Sarah, she is in the description box, in the description below, if you're watching this on the YouTube screen. And she will be back next week. What are we going to be talking about next week? Well, next week we're going to be looking at 9 hugely important big gigs, large-scale gigs, or festivals from the 90s. Yes. These are some of the most important ones that inspired people. These are some of the ones that celebrated people. And these are just some of the biggest festivals that showed up during the 90s, or the most significant ones anyway. So, yeah, look forward to that next week. There's a couple of good ones in there, and this will appease audiences from both sides of the pond, yes. So that's good. Next week on the 90s Gamer, we have another Dog Ate My Homework stream. I want to thank everybody who's taken the time out to watch our Dog Ate My Homework stream of Pokemon Red. We've got another stream that happened, actually just probably finished when you downloaded this podcast on Sunday. So, yeah, it's we've got another episode of it next week, and I'm looking forward to finishing it off because I've got another 2 games in mind. I've got another streaming series for our Dad Streamer project, and I've got another 90s Gamer in mind as well. So those will be information will be coming soon. And that really is it. That's all I've got to say for this week. I really don't have much to talk about anymore, you know, because we record these so far in advance. The stuff that I talk about is going to be out of date, and the stuff that is in date is not going to be talked about. So, unless something big happens, and then obviously I will mention it, you know, a couple of weeks after the fact. So, that'll be fun. So, that's it. I want everybody to take it easy. Have a fantastic week. Go eat your favorite food. Wear your favorite clothes. Take it easy. Peace, love, and understanding. I'll see you next time. Take it easy, everybody. Bye.